My guest today is the Sydney-based multi-instrumentalist and composer Stuart Vandegraaff, who we just heard, a lifelong devotee of jazz and other cultural musics. Stuart's abiding musical interest lies where jazz and other cultural music harmoniously blend. Chances are you've already heard Stuart Vandegraaff in ensembles such as Mash's Legacy, the Zella Mogossian Quintet, Azaduta, and the Mellow Tones Big Band, and numerous other ensembles, but he's finally released his first jazz release as a band leader, which naturally introduces all these fundamental influences. Stuart Vandegraaff, welcome to Now's the Time.
Thanks, Frank. It's a pleasure to be on board, and it's a pleasure to be on Northside Radio 99.3, one of my favourite radio stations in Sydney, I've got to say.
I introduce you as a multi-instrumentalist, but it's probably fair to say you're a saxophone player predominantly on this release. You're also proficient on the Arabic flute, the clarinets and other woodwind instruments. Can you tell us how you first were introduced to music and how your interest developed?
Oh, that's one of my favourite questions, Frank. When I was about six, no, I must have been about seven or something like that, I lived in a town on the edge of the desert in South Australia, a place called Port Augusta, and my brother, who's a couple of years older, wanted to get involved with the band program up there and brought home what he thought was a trumpet. He was quite set on playing the trumpet, and we opened the case when it got home, and he was disappointed that there was this saxophone there, and I saw this thing, and I was just completely enthralled. You know, it's an incredible looking instrument, something from the industrial era, all made from brass and leather, still, you know, native components, if you like. And I just wondered how on earth I could make this synthesis of technology and music and art and craftsmanship make music sing for me. And that's where I really developed a love for, and that was an alto saxophone that he brought home. He returned it the next day, and I was, you know, it took me about 5 years before I got one of my own. But that's where the infatuation, particularly with the alto saxophone, for me started. And I guess, well, we're close enough to 40 years later now, and it hasn't abated, not even a little bit. So that's where it really all started for me.
So in terms of Port Augusta, it would have been fairly isolated, I would have thought, and in terms of being sort of directly influenced by other passing musicians coming through, would have been fairly limited.
Very much so, but we were only in Port Augusta for about a year and a half. My dad was a government, he's a vet actually, an epidemiologist, and we kept on getting postings to different regional positions. So before that, we'd been in Port Lincoln. Not long after, we moved to Adelaide, and I ended up at a decent school in Adelaide where there was a good band program, and the band leader at the school, well, I guess there were a lot of connections at that particular school, but one of the early influences who I had direct contact with was the great late Don Burrows, who came to school, and it was when James Morrison and Don Burrows were doing a lot of the rounds of local schools. In particular, it's before he set up in Mount Gambier, but I think there were tendencies in that direction. Of course, you know about the generations in jazz that happens down there. There's many great players in Sydney who are graduates of that particular program or award winners through that program. So I was introduced to that level, that caliber of musicianship very early, and James and Don would come and do these masterclasses and workshops and concerts with the school band. And so I got to play lead alto sitting, well, more or less next to Don Burrows while Don took all the solos, and just being completely amazed. And it was also the band leader there. I'll give him a shout out. He's probably not listening. I don't even know where he lives these days. I think he was in Mount Gambier for a while. But Dave Longdon was the band leader at school there, and he dubbed me off a tape at one stage, which was labelled Charlie Parker. And I thought I was... I loved that, you know, old-school cassette tape that Dave dubbed off for me. It's really a very intimate act of giving, actually, you know, spending the time dubbing off a tape for somebody. And I thought I was listening to Charlie Parker. Turns out that it was actually an album by Phil Wood, the great alto player, who married Charlie Parker's last wife, Chan Richardson, and inherited a lot of his estate, and played very much in the vein of the beboppers, but then extended it further out. The album was called Musique de Bois, and that was the first thing that I transcribed. I think I was 13 years old, and I worked on the Summer Nose. I really loved that ballad that he played on that particular album, and later on I transcribed all the tracks on the album, including Erigen, and it's a wonderful, wonderful album that he recorded after he'd come back to the United States after spending many years in Europe. And Phil was absolutely on fire on the session. And it's that small act, I think, that really catapulted me into the level of consciousness I think that you need to become a proficient performer on the instrument. So alto saxophone is still my home base, if you like, and I'm very much coming from Charlie Parker, from Phil Woods, from Paul Desmond, from Lee Konitz, and from all those old beboppers, but then tempered by, you know, the later players, Steve Coleman and Kenny Garrett, and a lot of the great American players who you know, come from that tradition.
But it's also heartening to hear that you're living proof of the validity of spending money on touring musicians educating students into regional areas.
Yeah, I think that's very true, and I think that's very important. Even today, I'm very happy to be part of the Music Aviva in Schools program, which really does get some of Australia's best musicians into schools, in front of kids, mainly primary school age kids, and introducing them to not just sort of the standard down the line, you know, approach to music, but I mean, I've been watching some musicians from Western Australia, Mark Kane, who's one of, you know, the children of Lindsay Pollock, if you like, with that completely, you know, just entertaining take on music, which is not about cerebrality so much as just pure enjoyment. And I think that is really critical, that people, children be exposed to that and be inspired by that at an early age. And you never know where the next great player is going to come from. I mean, I've played with players from, I mean, there's a lot of players from Tamworth. I think Elson Price, the bass player on the album, has been very exposed to music, and he spent a lot of time growing up in Tamworth. And I know a lot of other people who've come from regional areas who otherwise wouldn't have been exposed to such a calibre and the possibilities that music can offer in that way.
But Stuart, the burning question for me is, what's the reason you've deferred that step of recording and releasing a jazz album of your own? Why has it taken you this long?
That's a really difficult question to answer, Frank. I don't know. I guess in many ways I felt like it might have been better if I had released some of these tunes even. I mean, some of the tunes on the album I composed in the 90s when I was a student at Adelaide Conservatorium doing my undergraduate down there. And, you know, potentially if I'd recorded and had the chutzpah, I suppose, to release that music back in the day, I might have, you know, made greater inroads into the jazz world. As things are, I have no regrets, but these recordings or these particular tunes, they have deep meaning. I do feel like there needs to be a long gestation period for a jazz artist in particular. I think before you have much to say musically, there are dues to pay, if you know what I mean. You have to go and do the standards gigs, and you have to do the hard work and understand. You have to live the life. There's an old adage in music that says, you know, jazz musicians don't release anything worthwhile until after they're 40. I mean, it's not true, because Bird died by the time he was 36, and he'd recorded prolifically and all that. But there's some grain of truth to that, and I suppose I was paying heed to that while you know, doing all the professionalizing activities that I felt would further my artistic creative path, you know, like taking jobs in the Navy band and later on the police band, which were wonderful experiences and definitely great teeth-cutting grounds for musicians. Reading all those dots and being involved in lots of other music projects, touring the world with bands like Lola Lavina and Azaduta and different groups like that. And also as a promoter, you know, I've been involved with radio on Eastside Radio and also doing reviews and that sort of thing, doing things what I consider to be very much at the community level. So it's not just about being a performer for me, it's about actually community music is really one of my driving passions, and I do really enjoy being involved. I think there could be a greater sense of continuum between beginner students and the elite professionals, particularly in Australia. That, you know, for instance, in places like Brazil, where I've toured a couple of times, there seems to be a greater continuity and engagement with music at all levels. So I don't know if that really answers your question. It's taken me this long. I felt like it's the right time to do this now. And incidentally, the recording was made 2 years ago. It was, I mean, who could have foreseen that? Well, I suppose there's some people who gazed into their crystal ball and knew that there was a pandemic around the corner, which was going to fundamentally change our industry forever. But at the time, I recorded the session and sort of put it in the can, if you like. It was the third session I'd had at Richie Belkner's Free Energy Device studio in about 6 weeks. I'd been in there and out, and you know, I really like working with Richard. He's an old friend from Adelaide, 25 years I've known Richie. And I hadn't given it much thought. And then I listened to it, you know, at the beginning of the shutdown period. I think it was about February. And I thought, you know, well, that moment in time when we were all so loose, and there was such a buoyant scene of gigging and hanging out and rehearsing and activity going on. And maybe things aren't going to be that way again. And I listened to the energy on that recording. It's not a terribly deeply considered recording. It's really a session that I invited some friends in to just, you know, lay down these tunes. I listened to the energy of the recordings and I thought, that's worth putting out there in the world. And that's in particular why I'm putting this album out. I've got other, you know, things on ice, if you like, that I've recorded. But this set of tunes, I thought there was great energy in there. And it does say something about the times in, about almost exactly this time, October in 2018 was when we recorded it. And it's very different times back then than what they are now.
Stuart, you of all people know that jazz has always been a melting pot of different cultural musics. I think of the Hot Club of Paris, Dizzy Gillespie's Cuban-influenced big band, Stan Getz, even Australia's jazz icon Graham Bell and his foray into Eastern Europe back in the late 1940s. What do you think it is about jazz that almost invites these cultural amalgams?
Again, a great question. I think it's within the nature of jazz. I think it's encoded in its DNA, actually. I do consider what I've done with Marsha's Legacy to be absolutely in the line of, you know, jazz, the jazz idiom, although most people would consider that more world music, for instance. So in a place like Australia, I've leaned towards the Middle East quite heavily because I married into that and it's become part of my reality now. So it's as much relevant to my reality as an artist and a creator as is the American jazz tradition, if you like. The American jazz tradition is almost like a separate culture. It's a separate culture from the Australian culture. It's appropriate to incorporate that within what we do here, but it equally is. I have more Turkish friends than I have American friends, for instance. So it makes sense that I incorporate that personally into my idiolect, if you like, the way I present and conceive my ideas. Part of that is microtonality, and I think that there is a huge amount of expressive possibility within other music systems that incorporate, in a more formalized way, notes that are outside the 12-tone system. So that's an area that I've explored quite deeply, in particular through Arabic maqam, the modal system of Arabic music. So to me, this is all jazz. This is all part of the same conversation, if you like. And I know that there's lots of people out there who don't think that, and I absolutely respect that opinion, but for me, that's my reality. You know, I have children who have origins from the Middle East, and I've been across to that part of the world many times, as I've been to India many times, as I've been to Brazil many times. And it makes sense for me to incorporate that as part. I mean, as artists, I guess what we do is we reflect what's going on in our own personal environment, but also maybe with a bit of perspective politically and culturally and all that sort of thing. So rather than a sense of appropriation, it's more of a expression of my reality that I incorporate those sorts of elements into my music particularly. And I think that's probably true of lots of other musicians. I know, for instance, Simon Barker is quite a controversial influence in jazz particularly. He's one of those almost polarizing forces. But through his incorporation of Korean shamanic drumming techniques, he's accessed an incredible diversity of experience and possibility and language that he's been able to incorporate in his expression of contemporary modern Australian jazz. And the other part of that is that we the cultural makeup of Australia has really fundamentally changed. It's no longer European centric or American centric even. We've got wonderful migrant communities from absolutely every nation in the world, and I think it's an act of inclusivity to access and to build those bridges between, you know, I guess what you'd think of as dinky dialy, you know, blue blood, true blue culture, and the migrant communities who are now adding in so many ways to the Australian experience. The analogy that I like to draw quite often is that of cooking. People don't think twice of, you know, adding a bit of extra spice to a traditional dish. You know, that people zhuzh up their legs of lamb or something like that with some Indian spice. But when it comes to music, they're much more reticent to do that sort of thing. And I'm not. I'm as adventurous in the kitchen as I am in the studio, in the music studio. And that obviously has effects on the output of what I do. And I think there's a culture of Australian musicians who are engaged with that mentality of music making, I think.
Stuart, this is a digital-only release. And in your opinion, what is this telling us about the future of music consumption? Because we know that vinyl records are now outselling CD sales. But on the other side, I continue to receive a constant flow of hard copy CD releases from countries such as Canada, but you've mentioned ethical reasons for launching this digitally only.
I'm very reluctant to use plastic in any form at all. That really comes down to that. I shop at Flemington Markets and I take recyclable bags, which are actually made from recycled plastic bags. And I think our plastic use as a household, as a family, is maybe half dozen bags a year or something like that. So it's just, I think people are using too much plastic, and that's the essential reason why I'm not doing a physical release of this. There's also the fact that, absolutely, as you mentioned, that digital streaming is the way that things are going at the moment. And I do know that there's a level of collectors out there who are collecting vinyl, and I'm not, passing judgment on that at all. I think collectors, fan sort of collection of material is wonderful, and it's great that it's out there. But for me, I would prefer not to. It's about my footprint in the world, really, and I don't want to create a greater footprint in the world than is absolutely necessary. It's music that we're dealing with at the end of the day, and what I really love most as a musician is performance. I love that thing that we do where a group of really talented, committed professionals get together and perform live, and the audience come along and the audience become part of the band for that night. We use the energy, we create a beautiful feedback loop with the audience, and we elevate each other. And at the end of the day, when I see people with shining eyes and smiles on their faces, that's really what it's all about. So the digital release is really a way of getting the music out there so people know what this particular project is all about, and then encouraging people to come along to the live performances. I'm really much more about the live performance of music. I do think that the subsequent performances that we'll do of the material will be better than what's recorded, because we have that live element to it. We have the energy of the audience who are in there. We don't have that slight nervousness of being in the studio and, being aware that the clock's ticking and that the bills are piling up, if you like. So I'm much more about that visceral component of performing live, and the digital release or the recorded format is just a way of, I guess, drawing attention to that. It's not really the end game. The end game for me is to perform more and keep that process of generating more material and more repertoire and improving our improvisation and improving our group connection in that way.
And this is one from your own pen. It's entitled Safe Haven. And I know that there is a story beyond this or where this grows from. Can you tell us about that?
I can. Okay, so Safe Haven, it's the unusual track on the album for many reasons. It's actually drawn from the Mushers Legacy repertoire. It's one of the tunes that we perform with that other group, which I'm the band leader of as well, our intercultural fusion group. There's two things that are different about, there's that aspect of it which is different, and there's the other aspect, which is that it incorporates microtonality. I mentioned earlier, and I did my master's dissertation studying microtonality, as I mentioned, drawn from Arabic maqam, the modal system of Arabic music, or Middle Eastern music, I'd prefer to say. So it's a specific story. I don't want to name individuals because there's sort of sensitivity around the story itself, but there's echoes for many, many people who've been in that similar situation, who've had to escape from the country that they were, that is so much deeply part of their identity. And because of religious persecution or political difficulty, or that they said the wrong thing at the wrong time, and all of a sudden they knew that they were there was a hit out of them or something like that. It's a very common story. Families who've been forced into leaky boats that go to sea, and some of them make it. And when they get to the other side, there's usually not a not a really safe resolution for them at any time. When I wrote Safe Haven, it was at the time when our borders were closed. Our political leadership at the time had said there will be no more. If you come by boat, you will not end up being settled in Australia, which I thought was, I'm sorry to be political, but that's, I guess, what the song's really all about. Mm. I thought that was fundamentally anti-human rights and undemocratic, and it didn't represent my values as an Australian. And I think that there's lots of people who feel the same way about that. And I hope I'm not offending your listeners by sort of going down this particular path, but it really offended me to the core that we had this political leadership that just carte blanche said, we're going to reject these people who are coming here. I mean, it takes an act of singular desperation to come out to, from Indonesia, for instance, on a leaky boat and put all of your chips in that one basket. And if the boat goes down, you're dead. You know, there's no chance for you. And even when you get here, there's no happy resolution. So the tune itself is in three sections, as you'll hear in just a second. The first is in that Arabic mode, Makam Bayati, which means home. It's got a sense of home to it, that Bayati is my home. But it's an uneasy sort of home. You can feel that there's tension there. The middle section of the tune is representative of the leaky boat, jumping in the leaky boat at sea. That's the piano solo that Nick Southcott so beautifully portrays. And it's very dramatic, and you'll hear that there is a sense of calm, a strange sense of calm, but also a sense of agitation or something like that. And then the final section of the tune, this particular story that I was referring to in Safe Haven, the migrant was from Iraq and ended up in Spain. So by crossing many borders and by crossing the Mediterranean after an incredible journey. And so the last section of the tune is a sense of, it's a really jubilant Baleares flamenco derived melody, which has something of that optimism of, well, you know, I made it, jubilation, but also, well, you know, what the heck happens now? And unfortunately, in the story of this particular person, they were caught and sent back to Iraq, where they discovered that the brother and the father had actually, they'd been killed by the regime, and they had been returned essentially to that same danger. There was no sense of resolution to it. So that's a particular story in that case of the family that motivated the story behind Safe Haven. But as I say, it's a story that's reflected in the experiences of many migrants, many people who've have been forced into desperate situations. And in my own small way, I'm making a comment about that. That's all I can do. You know, in the position that I'm in, I'm not a politician. I'm a musician. I'm an artist, and I can just make a comment about that experience through music, and hopefully draw attention to that, and maybe we'll find more compassionate ways of dealing with people who are in such incredibly desperate situations, and finding better ways of making it so that those desperate situations aren't fostered by successive governments. It's very political, I'm sorry, Frank, but that's the way it goes.
It's a great way of creating awareness. Stuart van der Graaf, we've run out of time, but thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Frank. I really appreciate it, and I very much thank all the listeners on Northside Radio 99.3.